This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. I was recently visiting a small CV ICU to see how they were doing and to do a gap analysis prior to an intensive training with them. They were so excited to show me a patient that was sitting up in a chair on room air looking great. They then showed me pictures of him intubated and clearly very deconditioned. They said that he had a femoral balloon pump and was completely flat for about a week and was then struggling to wean off of the ventilator. The intensivist was preparing to do a tracheostomy on the patient when the physical therapist and the nurses rallied together and convinced him to hold off a while they focused on mobilizing him. They were able to successfully extubate him without having to do a tracheostomy. The effort, teamwork, and skill required to mobilize this man that barely had any head control was rooted in such deep compassion and vision from this team. This was an absolute success in ICU rehabilitation. I honor and celebrate them. At the same time, looking at these pictures of the group and equipment working so hard to sit him up and fight ICU-acquired weakness, I couldn't help but ask, could this ICU-acquired weakness have been prevented? Obviously, with a femoral balloon pump, there is concern and precaution needed to avoid bending at the hip. Yet, was laying completely flat without any movement totally necessary? Could they have prehabilitated him with interventions such as standing on a verticalization bed? Could he have walked off of such a bed without bending at the hip and therefore maintained his ability to walk? This episode, I'm thrilled to have the creator of the Ramsey Scale, Stephen Ramsey, here with us to talk about his pioneer work in mobilizing patients with high acuities, life-sustaining devices, and even a variety of femoral access. The Stephen Ramsey is finally on the podcast. I have been collecting interviews with different pioneers and revolutionists throughout this podcast, and it really felt incomplete with having the Stephen Ramsey on. Stephen, can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I am Stephen Ramsey. I don't know about the Stephen Ramsey, but practicing in Atlanta, Georgia, in a cardiovascular ICU at a big facility here in Atlanta. Been doing that for about 8 years. And in the midst of that, also did a residency and then mentored in a residency and run a residency. And currently teaching a little bit on the side as well. So, but yeah, most of my research experience and certainly all of my clinical experience has been in the CVICU with patients on mechanical support. So just happy to be here and talking with you about this stuff.
Absolutely. I hear your name all the time come up, especially when people ask questions about mobilizing with femoral cannulation and ECMO and all these things. They always refer to the Ramsey protocols. I know that you mentored Jenna Hightower, who I think is an excellent resource and expert. And so tell us more about what was it like when you entered the field at the beginning of your career? What were the standard practices and what inspired you to push the envelope? What led you to ask why not? What if?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I was a bit naive when I first started. And the simple question was, I don't understand why these patients can't get up and move. I think that was my big kind of curiosity, was what's the limitation here? What are the barriers? And, you know, at that time, the question was primarily about these patients that had femoral balloon pumps that were, you know, in the ICU awaiting sort of a Plavix washout, awaiting CT surgery. And they were just kind of there for 5-6 days kind of laying. So I thought, initially started with exercise with these patients. And once I learned more about the balloon pump, I thought, if I can limit the hip flexion, which seems to be the biggest barrier for these patients, could I in fact get them standing? And if I can get them standing and knowing what I know just biomechanically about ambulation, could I keep them, could I get them walking without exceeding the 30 degrees of hip flexion? So that's where the question started. And I think I was really lucky because I posed that question to our ICU director, who was former CT surgeon, you know, boarded in many different things, so has tons of experience. And he was like, yeah, let's just do it. And then the scary part was then I was like, oh crap, I have to do it now. You know, this has all been theoretical. And I think that that first time was really nerve wracking. So I had the whole idea planned. I was going to get a tilt table. I was going to get them up and standing and limit hip flexion and then have them step off and walk. And I think, again, luckily for me, the first few sessions that we did went well. I think that was huge, that there wasn't any sort of intolerance to upright. The balloon pump functioned perfectly. Their blood pressure was stable. These patients tolerated it well and actually voiced how much they enjoyed doing that because they had been laying there. And so at that point, then we started to collect some of that data to say, all right, well, the first one went well. What's the true need here in our hospital and potentially other hospitals? How many patients are actually laying here kind of waiting on surgery? And is this worth the risk or the theoretical risk to do this? So we collected some data, did some background digging. And as you imagine, we called a lot of places and everybody said, don't do it. Luckily that did not deter us. We called the reps for the balloon pumps. We called other facilities and got a lot of you're crazy, don't do that kind of stuff. Meanwhile, this was all like while I was in, you know, residency at the time. So I was like, this is a great research opportunity for me as a resident, you know, new to the field, new to the ICU. But to, you know, sort of get back to the point here, I did all of this because I was a little bit naive and luckily it went really well. So we did a little bit of work on the back end of that first session to kind of make this a protocol and make sure that we are collecting the appropriate data and then disseminating that information out to people.
And you know, I said many times that there's so much value in a new and fresh perspective. Yeah. I don't know if I would have questioned all these things or been able to be such a revolutionist if I hadn't started in an awake and walk in ICU where it was normalized. So I have so much respect for people that come in and are adaptable to the cultural norms and the protocols that are implemented, but also have a bigger perspective of saying, is there a reason for this? Why? Why not? What if? But being new, I think, does make you more malleable, does make you say, well, ask questions because you're asking questions anyways. You're learning and you're there to learn. So saying, why aren't we doing this? Why aren't we mobilizing our patients? And as a physical therapist, you are there to mobilize patients. So right. You really should know why there is a reason not to. And you didn't sounds like you didn't even accept the reason why not to, which was.
Yeah, absolutely. It didn't make sense to me. I mean, it does not make sense that, okay, they can't flex past 30. Well, there's tons of ways we can get patients up without bending the hip. So what is another reason? And then you get all of the aorta is going to rupture, the balloon's going to rupture, you know, they're going to dissect, they're going to die and all this stuff. And again, I had this in my mind, it seems so simple. Well, let's stand. If that goes well, we'll march in place. If that goes well, we'll step off. If that goes well, we'll walk. And I think that was the whole premise behind that. And so at the time, I certainly did not understand that this was a big barrier for a lot of facilities, that I was doing anything that was out of the norm. I was just trying to, like you said, find a way to move a patient that needed to be moved.
And it sounds like you were really trying to do it soon before they lost the ability to move.
100%. Yeah.
And as a physical therapist, that should be one of your primary focuses. But if you work in the rest of the ICU community, you can see that that's just accepted, that patients are going to lose the ability to walk.
Yeah.
But that to you was unacceptable.
Yeah. And that's been my feeling about this since I started in the ICU. And I tell this kind of story all the time to people that I'm working with or training or mentoring, that when I first started, I mean, it's literally like, you can probably speak to this too. It's literally banging your head against the wall. You're pushing against concrete of resistance from your colleagues and all these coworkers that respect you and you respect. And that's just like, hey, this is the way it is. You can't do these things. And I think it just takes a little bit of somebody that doesn't like to hear no. I don't know if you're familiar with the color profile. I'm a blue, which means I'm a people pleaser. And I had to become an orange. I had to become a rule breaker a little bit because I was like, I cannot accept that we're not going to do it just because that's the way that's always been done. And so at our facility, we weren't super aggressive with early mobility. It really started then when if you're seeing a femoral balloon pump walk around, why are we not walking patients that are just on ventilators? Why are we keeping them sedated? Why are we not pushing the envelope with ECMO and things like that? So I think that was a big open door for us to be aggressive with the rest of the population. And I actually think that that's a great strategy for people, is if you're mobilizing patients that are theoretically the sickest, what's the excuse for the rest of the patients in your ICU? Don't let that be a barrier that they're sedated or that the staff is uncomfortable or that there's no culture for early mobility. It takes somebody that's willing to create that and push against the envelope.
And now you're speaking to an audience of primarily ICU revolutionists that know that cement wall all too well. Some people that are listening to the podcast have been pushing for this for years and they feel so discouraged and frustrated. And absolutely not every personality is going to be wanting to push the envelope. I'm half red, half blue. And so the blue side of me is just constantly panicked about what I'm doing. The red side of me is going crazy over pushing the envelope. So I have a constant inner battle. So I really feel for people that are blues, that want to please people, that don't want to ruffle feathers, that don't want to offend people. We had a couple episodes ago, or even last episode, a pharmacist that would say in rounds, "We are killing people." And it didn't go over well with her colleagues. But it's really hard to navigate being honest about the harm that's happening. And a lot of these changes are well-founded. Now, your changes, you were founding. So yeah. I think that's even braver to be that kind of visionary. I mean, you were collecting data, you were looking at it statistically to make sure that this was a reliable pattern of being safe and feasible. And I want to talk about some of the things that you do to make it safe, because I've had questions about this. But now we, like you're saying, we walk some of the most critical, high acuity, complex patients with tenuous devices. And yet in other ICUs, even sometimes in the same hospital, their patients on mechanical ventilation for one organ failure, usually acute respiratory failure. Right. They're deeply sedated and now they're acquiring all the other complications. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it's this, it still kind of spawns from this idea that we have to keep patients comfortable and calm. And I think that it doesn't recognize, to your point, that bed rest is active harm, right? That this actually is a short-term solution that's creating a long-term problem. And in my experience and in places that do early mobility well, if you're just getting anecdotal information from the patients, they really want to be awake and they really want to be communicative and they really want to be mobile. And I think a lot of us as healthcare professionals, if we're really truly about what's best for the patient and their comfort, then I think that early mobility is the answer for that. And I think the only caveat to that is the way that we communicate that, the way that we approach it, the way that we consent the patient, it requires one, competence, because in my belief, competence drives confidence. And if you're competent and confident, then your patients feel that and they know that, and then your family members see it. And so then they start to buy into the benefits as well. Because I've had people that say, hey, the staff's on board, but some of the families and patients are actually the ones that are not. And my question to them is always, is this, how are you selling it? What are you saying about this? How confident are you in your ability to move this patient safely? And I think that, you know, a lot of times that conversation helps break that barrier down, because I think patients go as the healthcare providers go a little bit.
Absolutely. If you walk in, you're like, hey, Mrs. Brown, we're going to get you up. And it's going to be, I know you're really scared, and you're like showing that you're really, as a clinician, that you're really scared. And then we're fumbling and we're trembling and, they can feel that. And even when you are confident, they're going to probably have some concerns. They know it's their lifeline that's down their throat. They know it's a lot of equipment. They know they're sick. But when you, as a clinician, walk in and say, this is as routine and optional as an antibiotic, this is to save your life, we do this with our patients, this is how you're going to walk out of here, you're going to be okay, we've done this, we're experienced, there, it's really hard to say no to that. But then how do you develop that kind of competency and confidence if you're one of the only revolutionists on your team, if you've never really done it before? How do you get there? And that's why as a consultant and as my consulting team, we do simulation training. And I think it's really important to do that routinely so that everyone can practice in a safe environment when it's not a real patient, but you have your real equipment, you're figuring out your process. Obviously you don't want to fake competency, but we also do have to trust the research that shows that if we do this systematically and with the right patients, there's a 0.6% adverse event rate. And very few of those are actually serious events. So we have to have a shift in perspective, but also the opportunity for our clinicians to become that competent.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I think that's mentorship is the key to this. If you're at a facility that you don't have, maybe you don't have the reps because the team is not on board, or maybe you're at a facility that doesn't have a robust ICU in general and you're trying to get into that, I think the mentorship piece is invaluable for that. And I think you're right. I think there's no replacement for live patients, real touches. But you have to start with what is the procedural steps here? And I need to get reps to drive that confidence. When I was early in my career, I hated protocols. I hated them because it was that same mindset of, I want to, like, we are truly, you know, in the PT profession, we're trying to push for sort of autonomy, quote unquote, right? To be independent practitioners making decisions. And I just hated this idea that somebody else would tell me how to do it. But I do think that there's value in having protocols and procedures when you're starting. And I think that that helps you get some framework around what is it supposed to look like. And then I think once you get some touches and reps, then I think you start to use your creativity to know how to, maybe you go off script, you go off protocol or off procedure to try to optimize mobilization of the patient.
Yeah. And different ways as far as what equipment to use, how to navigate the IV pump and the ventilator. Some people like to walk backwards as RT. Some people like to walk forwards. I mean, some of that is a personal preference. Some of that depends on the patient. I mean, there's just so much that I think is really overwhelming to consider adjusting. But once you get a very general scaffolding to the protocol, everyone understands and understands their process, it becomes streamlined and adaptable. I think about like proning patients. I use that example all the time because initially it took so many people, so much time. It was really scary. You tried to get a really rough protocol and now it's streamlined. We understand what we're doing and how to get there. And so I see with teams that are starting, they'll report back and say, we just got someone to the chair. It took 30 minutes. We cannot take 30 minutes to get someone to the chair every time. Right. And I said, absolutely. Of course you can't. And it's not going to take that much time the next time and the next time. And it's just going to get quicker, but teams need enough support, enough staffing to allow that kind of luxury of spending that kind of time trying to navigate everything when it's so, you have to think through every little step at the very beginning of an early mobility program.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's how it started with us. It took, I mean, when we first ambulated femoral VA ECMO in 2015, there was three perfusionists, two physicians, a physician assistant. There was three nurses. There's two PTs. I mean, like, you should have seen this parade that was happening for, honestly, a patient that was pretty functional, pretty strong. And it was just this huge thing. And then all of a sudden you look around now and it's 2024 and it's, you know, me and the nurse, or me and the nurse and the perfusionist. And I think it does. It just takes, you know, it takes a lot of support on the front end to get it off the ground. It takes diligence in preventing significant complications. And to your point, there's really not a ton of risk with moving these patients, what we're finding out. And I think once people start to see success, then I think that starts to breed more excitement about early mobilization and rehabilitation.
Absolutely. And it feels like so much work up front.
Yeah.
And then what I'm seeing with these teams is once they get more comfortable with it, they don't even talk about the workload. I had an RT in a team that where the RTs were some of the biggest barriers. And this was, I mean, in 21, I think, that I was training them. And they were just so hesitant, saying, we're already underwater. We're so maxed out. We don't have time for anything else. Very valid concerns, right? Later, this RT, like about a year later, she goes, well, early mobility doesn't take that long. And I was like, hold on. That's not the song you were singing a year ago.
Right.
So as you know, now I use her to train other teams. Her name is Emily. She's amazing because she really understands their perspective. But I had to remind her of her initial perspective because it had become so instinctive for her and her entire team.
Right.
When you have new people come onto your team, maybe PTs from other facilities, RNs from other facilities, How do you help them understand that this is the norm and develop that skill set as well?
Yeah, I think that now that you're in a, like, if you're in a place where it's established, I think it's so much easier to get people to buy in because they can look around and watch it happening. So I think that there's less, less concern when you're seeing it happen in real time and you're like, I didn't think this was possible. I think that people buy in a lot quicker. I will say, from especially if people have experience, I think there's part of that where it's breaking down, maybe not habits, but just old ways of thinking and old approaches to patient care and trying to get them to see that all these barriers that maybe they were told to you at one point, or maybe you've built up these barriers in your mind to mobilizing the patient, they really don't exist. And let me prove it to you by that patient on ECMO with a balloon pump that's on 2 inotropes and 3 pressors and intubated. That person just got up. Okay, so now look at your patient that's on 15 mics of propofol, you know, and they're kind of groggy and the nurse doesn't want to do it. Like, you know, you have really no excuses at that point. So I think that's what helps us is if we're mobilizing the sickest again, then I think there's really no excuse to not mobilize the rest of the patients in the ICU. And I do think though that staffing has been really challenging to that point. So not only staffing to do the early mobilization, staffing to train the new people, right? To make sure that they're getting good habits and they're exposed to quality care on both sides, the nursing side and the rehab side. And that I think is probably a challenge everywhere. And you could probably speak to that. That's a challenge in many facilities across the country, across the world.
Because so much of what makes this safe is the experience, the expertise, mm-hmm. the knowledge, and how you approach it. You guys make it look so easy. But now that I'm on this back end of trying to teach it, I've come to really appreciate that it isn't as easy. Like when I put myself in the position of those that have never done it before, I'm trying to explain, you know, I sometimes try to think, okay, when you go to teach a brand new nursing student how to hang an IV, it's not that mm-hmm. easy to explain. It's because now it's something that you just do. It's just instinctive. It's almost like muscle memory. You're critically thinking without realizing that you're critically thinking. And so it takes a teacher to be able to teach that. So to find the right staff that's able to be a mentor, able to have the time to really teach the next generation to make sure that they are safe to be doing this. It doesn't make sense for any other procedure that we would just throw them into and expect them to do it, right? Like you would never, as a nurse practitioner, I didn't just like graduate and just start doing chest tubes and intubations mm-hmm. without training and following mm-hmm. protocols. Yet when it comes to early mobility, it feels like so often maybe hospital administrators, clinical leadership is saying, this is good. This is a great thing. We should be doing it now. Clinicians, go do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Without any training. And then to expect the next generation that's coming in to just pick it up and do it, that's not safe or fair.
Yeah. Well, I think that actually sets us up for failure when we're having non-competent and confident people doing it. Then I think that's when you run into some risk and some complications and some oversights. And then all of a sudden the administrators are like, wait a second, I thought this was supposed to be great. And it's not. Some things are happening that we don't love. Like, let's just shut this program down. And I think that's where if we don't approach it in the right way with the right administrative support and staffing support, I think when you're starting a new program, I think you're at risk. And it's not just they do it over there, so let's do it here. I think it does take, again, that mentorship piece, the commitment to doing it the right way. And there is a right way and there is a wrong way to starting a program like that when you're trying to be really aggressive.
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more. It was your team, right, that put out a study just recently showing some of the financial benefits of it. The impact to length of stay for every 10 additional minutes of early mobility.
That wasn't our group, but I saw that article and that's exactly my point, right? That's the benefit, right? We know that there's benefit to this, and that's the paper that you drop on the desk of the administrator and you say, it can work, but we need this, this, and this. Like, we can't just start it. You know, we have to have the support.
I tell administrators when I'm doing a financial pitch that if they just turn around and tell their clinicians, turn off sedation, get them walking without mm-hmm. providing real support in terms of staffing, equipment, training, mm-hmm. they're going to have a mutiny on their hands.
Yeah.
This could either totally trigger up the trauma from COVID, or it could help heal it. And so they're really at a crossroads with how they approach this. That study, by the way, I'll put the link in the transcript, showed over one day decrease in length of stay for every 10 additional minutes to early mobility, which is, just case closed, but it's amazing how they're always looking for ways to decrease costs, decrease mm-hmm. hospital acquired complications, decrease mm-hmm. length of stay, and boom, 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 early mobility hits it all. And yet it seems like that's the last thing to ever be approached or attempted or supported.
Right. I agree. And that's what we see even at our facility. Like, when we're thinking we're being really aggressive, there's still these barriers. And it's like, hey guys, we've not only can read the data, we've seen the benefit for the patient. Why are we going back on this? And I do think I think it's the making decisions that are short-term that have long-term impacts and not really still sticking to what we know is true long-term, which is move the patients. Not only is it safe, but it's also beneficial. And I think that's, and even, after the team trial came out, I think that you see a lot of clinicians that have come out and said, hey, look, we can talk about the specifics of the article. And I think you've done a great job with that already. So we won't, but I will say the clinicians on the ground are like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, this is still the right thing to do for the patient. This is still best practice. It's still active harm to not move the patient. And so I think we just have to keep that at the forefront, that this is better for the patients. This is not just a cost savings. It's not just a decreased risk of pressure ulcer and ventilator acquired pneumonias and all these things. It's also better for them from a psychological, mental, spiritual, emotional standpoint. And I think that's so often missed in healthcare. I don't want to filibuster, but that sort of the patient first idea, I think that that's the missed piece here. And early mobility checks that box too.
And that study put out all these fears about there being increased risk and harm for early mobility, but not taking into account the incredible risk and harm. And I think mm-hmm. in the future, some legal and financial liability for not mobilizing patients. So
100%.
That whole narrative needs to change. Mm-hmm. One question that I received from a physical therapist in a CVICU, she said that she considers herself pretty aggressive and wants to find ways that make early mobility accessible for more patients. And so she was worried about how to mobilize patients with aortic balloon pumps mm-hmm. and how to have a worst case scenario backup plan in case something goes wrong, especially if they're in the hall. So how do you guys do it? Talk to me about the logistics.
Yeah. So I'll tell you the sort of the progression. When we first started, we had a tilt table and our tilt table, I think was, manufactured in the 70s, when we first started this, we had to take the face of the controller off and touch two wires together to get it to go up and down. Like, that's where we started, which I didn't love that at all. Like, it would get stuck up and standing and stuff. So it was crazy. So luckily we advanced to maybe a newer version of the tilt table. And then ultimately we got some VitalGo tilt beds, but which made our process a lot easier. But we would follow the patient. We would at least put the tilt table out in the hallway in case something happened. And that was always our concern is patient safety. So what do we do when we're 100 feet, 200 feet away from the room and the patient has some sort of complication, whether that's arrhythmia or hypotension or, worse than that, right? So I will say that, when I talk about this with our groups, we never had that complication. And knock on whatever is around you, Haley, we'll just knock on all the wood around us.
Yep.
We still haven't. And we've done, I think, in the initial article sort of published maybe around 70 patients, but we're, up north of 600, 700, 800 patients at this point, and still have not had a major complication. And what goes with that is a really robust screening process to start. a good chart review, understanding when it's the right time to say, no, we're not going to move this patient. I think that it speaks to the competency piece. And then having a structured approach to getting them to standing, progressing from standing to marching, marching to stepping off to walking. Usually the patients are in standing for 3 to 5 minutes before we start running down the hall. And if they're going to be orthostatic, we will have known that. If they're going to have some exertional hypotension or tachycardia that we're concerned about, we would know that when we're marching in place at the bedside. So that doesn't preclude any, you know, complication from happening. As you will appreciate this, things happen to really sick patients, and you can do everything you can do to control that. And that's just the way it is. A complication does not mean it was the wrong decision. A complication is the realization that these patients are really sick. So as long as you're kind of doing all of those things leading up, we haven't had any significant complication. But to answer the question, I think what people want to know is, what would you do? And we've done sim lab kind of thought through this a little bit, because you obviously don't want to sit the patient down with a femoral balloon pump. That's sort of the point of getting a tilt table and standing them. Don't sit them down, but you would get behind them and lie them down and sort of lower them to the ground if there's an emergency. And I think that's our approach to when that happens, not if, because it's going to happen at some point. And we're, you know, this is year 9 of doing this. So, you know, it's going to happen at some point, but that's the approach. And I wish I had a better answer, but I'm glad I don't, because if I had a better answer, it would be because we've experienced it and we haven't yet. So.
Which is amazing and probably shocks people with over 600 mobility sessions with patients with aortic balloon pumps. You've never had an adverse event, and yet you're always preparing for it, which I think is really key.
Yeah. Yeah. So never had so we categorize them in, you know, the minor and major. So we've never had a major complication that would be categorized as significant bleeding or arrest or arrhythmia or CVA. Now we've certainly had some minor complications, you know, sort of the minor bleeding at the site. We've had some minor migration, we've had some infection and things like that. But yeah, the catastrophic things, the major complications have not occurred. And even with talking with other facilities that are in the infancy of their femoral balloon pump mobilization, they're seeing some complications, but it's not the major type where they've dissected an aorta and a patient's died, right? It's the, you know, this patient is orthostatic, or this patient just complained of, you know, discomfort from, they felt this balloon pump and it made them kind of feel funny. Like that's sort of the major things that we're seeing, those kind of complications.
I really liked Sabrina Eggman's recent article in The Lancet, and I'll link that as well, talking about how we really need to be better classifying these adverse events, because there's a difference between serious adverse events and minor adverse events, and they still should be reported, but we need to classify them. And I think that was one of the hard things in discussing the team study, is not having a good classification of those adverse events. And that really provoked a lot of unwarranted fear.
Yeah. Yeah. And just for us as clinicians, a lot of questions, right? A lot of questions after that. What does that mean? How do we look for these complications if we don't have a list, sort of a robust list that's defining them?
And how do we track them, right? I mean, I think that's important too, is to be able to track adverse events, because if something happens, it's important to do a root cause analysis and say, was that preventable? What can we do better next time? And to make sure that we're doing this as safely as possible.
Yeah, I agree.
There's just so much to pick your brain about, but I think what we love to hear are case studies. Do you have any just off the top of your mind? I didn't prepare you for that, but what cool stories can you tell us? I know it's become so normal to you now.
Well, no, I think it's, you know, the cool stories are still the ones that stick out. So there's a couple that we're in process of writing up and trying to get out there. So I think one thing I've transitioned to a little bit in my career, and anybody that knows me and listens to this is going to like be laughing right now, but I use a lot of diagnostic ultrasound in practice now. So looking at the heart, looking at the aorta, looking at the IVC, kind of stuff like that, similar to what the medical team would be doing when they're ruling in, ruling out, you know, something in the ICU. So trying to incorporate that into practice led to us, we're seeing a patient that was on ECMO. He had a post-infarct VSD, so heart attack. The septal wall between the ventricles had a massive hole, like a 2-centimeter hole. So not a small hole. In fact, his shunt fraction, so the amount of blood going the wrong direction, was like 2.7 times the amount of blood going through his pulmonary outflow tract compared to his LV outflow tract, which is a concern.
Significant.
And this patient also had a balloon pump, thermal balloon pump. And so this is the type of guy that we're like, let's just, you know, let's stand up. Like, let's see what happens when we get him in vertical. And more than that, not just look at what happens from a physiology standpoint, you know, hemodynamic standpoint, but let's actually put a probe on his chest, get the shunt fraction, get some RV systolic measures in supine and standing with marching, and then see how that changes. And the interesting thing, and granted, this is an N of one, but the interesting thing when we did that, when we got an echo in supine and standing and with marching in place, we actually saw a shunt fraction reverse. So his QPQS dropped to almost 1:1, which is, you know, normal. We have normal amount of blood flow going to the right side, left side. His RV systolic function improved. He reported no symptoms and hemodynamically it was stable. But that was so interesting because the biggest fear is as I increase sympathetic input to the heart, I'm just making that shunt worse. The LV is just kicking all that blood over to the right side. And that wasn't the case. In fact, the RV sort of responded well in that scenario, even going from supine to standing, you know. And so I had all these fears in mind of what could have happened based on the fact that this guy had an infarct, you know, that we're taking away some of his preload by standing him up, that we're increasing exertion level on a heart that just was damaged, that's not fixed yet. But, you know, all that stuff was put to rest because we had real time objective assessment, right? We were using ultrasound. And I think
and you used a verticalization bed, right?
Yes. So we used
had a really controlled environment.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think too, and this is, I'm spoiled because in my mind, ECMO and balloon pumps and swans actually give us more data. And so they scare me less than the patient that has two peripheral IVs that's, you know, just in the ICU. I have any amount of information that I want, I've got at my fingertips. So that's where I feel at home. I know it's weird to say, but that's just kind of where I'm at with that. So that was a cool case study. And that person was able to progress towards ambulation, even on ECMO with a balloon pump, multiple sessions of ambulation prior to getting his infarct or his VSD repaired, which, you know, post-infarct VSDs, you really don't want to touch those for about 2 weeks after the infarct. So that was a cool case to keep him mobile for several weeks before he actually went to surgery and ultimately, you know, survived and went home. So
for several weeks before that.
Yeah.
So you were able to prehabilitate him knowing that he was going to have a period of unavoidable bed rest.
Yeah. And I still believe like in probably 99.9% of facilities, that guy's on bed rest. That guy is not moving.
Yep.
And that was nice. And now again, I always say this, bad things that happen to sick patients is doesn't mean it's the wrong decision. And just because that went well, doesn't mean every patient in that scenario meets criteria to move. So I think it is patient specific, you know, considering all of the things and making a decision as part of the medical team. And I'm speaking specifically of PTs. We have to come to the table with some real objective kind of thoughts about the patient, not just, is it okay if we start moving them? Are you guys cool with it? What should I look for? We have to actually be a part of that discussion. We have to speak the language.
There should be no single discipline that really shuts that down or is the gatekeeper of that, right? If you were to go just to the RN to say, can I mobilize your patient? It would put an absolutely no way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that should, the RN shouldn't be the only one to make that decision or the final say in that, which I think is happening in a lot of ICUs. So I'm definitely doing a victory dance right here because I think that's a really important point. But when PTs come with serious data, they're critically thinking, they can support their ideas and their proposals and really do a risk versus benefit analysis with the entire team. That's when we have true collaboration, not just asking for permission.
Right. 100%. That's why I tell all the PTs that I mentor or students that I teach, you have to speak the language. You cannot be a part of the discussion if you don't speak the language. And so that speaks to the competency part. And in PT school, we just quite frankly don't get the training that you need to have the conversations in the ICU. So it does require postgraduate, whether it's residency or however you get the access to the information, it's postgraduate mentorship is really what you need in the ICU. And you can't rely on other disciplines to drive it for you as the therapist. So I 100% agree with that.
I love that. What other stories do you have? I know people are going to eat this up.
Oh gosh. Let me think of some other good ones. Well, like all that come to mind are ultrasound related stories, but no, I mean, we have many, many sick patients on ECMO. So I'll say this, try not to give a ton of detail, but you know, there's different types of cannulas that we would use for ECMO. And I think in our facility, we're super creative to try to support the patient the best way we can. So we do a lot of transseptal cannulation, so draining the left side of the heart in order to decompress the left side, which a lot of facilities would use like an Impella to do that. We usually use an ECMO cannula to do that for us. Or, you know, in that case, that's a patient that, you know, the retrograde flow to the LV is too much. And so, yes, they need it for perfusion, but their LV is starting to balloon out and they need a transseptal. We've even used, you know, dual lumen single catheters like the Protect Duo or something like that, and put that up the apex of the LV to work as an LVAD. So those are some cool stories. And the cool part of that is the novelty of the use of the equipment from the medical standpoint, but then what's required from us is then how do we move that patient? Like, how do we monitor that patient and move that patient safely? So, yeah.
Are you ever involved in the discussions as to what kind of device to use and where to place it in regards to how will that impact mobility? Or are you just able to accommodate now because of all of your technology and expertise?
Yeah. So I love having the conversation, but I tell them all the time, whatever you put in, we'll figure out a way to do it. And so I think that frees the medical team up, whether they listen to me or not, I don't know. You know, I can't tell, but most of the time we've been successful moving the patient. So don't worry about the mobility. Let me worry about that part and do what you need to do to support the patient. And we'll figure out a way to move that patient. So I think that's been our approach there.
Now, I think that's going to hurt the brain of a lot of clinicians because you're in a very unique unit. You have to appreciate sure. that, right? So in many teams, ECMO is seen as a barrier, or femoral devices at all in general is still seen as a barrier. Right. And so things like that. Yeah. So it's really, that's a big statement. That's really powerful to say, we'll find a way, we'll figure it out. But again, that's not from a novice. That's just like, we'll just throw them out of bed. This is from years of expertise and an entire team that can support that process.
Yeah. And that, to that point, we just did some talks here at CSM, our combined section meeting for PT, which is great, but I'm still kind of shocked to hear that the barriers are what they are, like a femoral VAS cap, right? A femoral Swan-Ganz catheter. We're still femoral A-lines. Like, we're still talking about things that I thought in my mind, because of how unique the experience I have, I thought that was all things of the past. And that's not to say that that's minimizing that barrier. That's a real barrier for people. And so I like affirm that is really where people are. But the reality is, at PTs, it feels like we don't feel like we have the freedom to drive the conversation. And what I want to instill in people is, you do. One, there's data, which helps the conversation. But two, you're a PT. So drive the conversation and say, I can do it. We can make this safe. We can do it effectively. And that's driven us to now want to do maybe a complex cases kind of discussion at CSM, appreciating that not every facility can relate to the specific patients, but hopefully they can relate to the conversations, which is, this patient traditionally should not move. Let's figure out a way to make it safe and effective. And we'll drive that from the PT side.
I tell people all the time that PTs and OTs do not get their master's and their doctorate degrees to do passive range of motion or to only be rehabilitating on the very back end of critical illness.
Yeah.
It's exhausting and it's not the most productive.
No, and I probably have not responded with a much grace when I'm told to do that, right? Because I think there's a time and place, right? If we're trying to increase ventilation, just moving the joint can increase ventilation, right? That's helpful. There's things we can do from a cardiovascular and pulmonary standpoint by just moving the limb, but that doesn't need to be me doing it. And I think I've ruffled some feathers by saying, like, I'm just not going to do that. You know, I'm going to figure out other ways. And I think that the lesson for people, maybe use more tact and more grace, but also realize that there's more that we can offer than just moving the patient's limbs. That's my lesson there. I think there's a place for it, but it does not replace other things, right? It does not replace moving the patient in terms of getting them up out of bed, standing, walking.
And it probably shouldn't even fall in the same category as early mobility, especially in our research.
Nope.
Because that messes 100%. Up our data.
Yes. And that's the biggest thing I see in early mobility data is, what does that actually mean? And so if we're using these mobility scales, right? And zero is bed rest, and one is range of motion, and that's considered early mobility, then I think we have to redefine that a little bit. That's probably not early mobility, and not probably, it's definitely not early mobility.
So, no, anyone that looks at that data needs to scour and look into the methodology, look in the definition and the timing of mobility, the level of mobility. Right. Absolutely. Tell me as we wrap up about your Ramsey protocol.
Well, I hate the name. I'll say that.
Of course you would.
I struggle with it, you know, I did not name it that. There was a physician that I was working with on that paper that was like, you have to do that. That's just part of it. I'm glad I did in some ways, but I hate the name. That's where I'll start. Just the protocol was developed after several sessions of moving the patient, because in my opinion, you have to trial and error before you design a good protocol. And we're actually at the place with that protocol that it's outdated, right? Like, there's things that are different that we do now that need to be published and need to be put out there. And other facilities have adapted the Ramsey protocol, as you should, right? You should take it and make it make sense for you. But the whole point of the protocol is an approach to evaluating an appropriate patient once they're appropriate for mobility, which is, I don't want to gloss over that, right? That's an important step. You have to be able to assess their ability to participate, the safety of participating. Once you determine that they're a candidate, then this is just the protocol to move them safely. So we get them from supine up to full standing, stopping about every 30 degrees to assess vital signs, tolerance, balloon pump sight, all of those things, ultimately getting them into standing, progressing to marching, and then, you know, getting them off the tilt table or tilt bed and ambulating. And then the reverse of that is pretty self-explanatory. Get back to the bed, tilt back into supine, again, reassessing their tolerance to that change of position as well. That's actually where I've seen most people have symptoms, is going from standing to supine after they've just walked 2,000 feet around the unit. And I think there's something to be said there of kind of ramping down the sympathetic nervous system in a really sick patient, and not just going from activity to rest and then just putting them straight in supine, especially for our heart failure patients with dilated cardiomyopathies. We should not be slamming them from standing to supine. And that's where I've actually seen some symptoms that the patients may experience.
It sounds like verticalization beds should be standardized in every CVICU.
I believe that. They're not without their challenges, right? And I think everybody that's used tilt beds, they are perfect for what they're made to do, which is get the patient in standing. The movement of the bed, like physically pushing the bed and things like that, when they're on multiple mechanical devices, those things are, I think, being updated and changed. There's companies that are working on designing these beds, you know, to be more similar to like the Stryker ICU beds and things like that, from a drive function and just some of the features of the mattress. But yeah, I 100% believe that every hospital should have access to a tilt bed. And if not a tilt bed, at least a tilt table that they're using in the ICU. Like, go steal it from the outpatient clinic and take it to your ICU. That would be my recommendation.
And keep it, because you shouldn't have to run around with everything you have to do. You shouldn't have to hunt down equipment.
The best early mobility, you know, advocates are ones that steal equipment, in my opinion. Steal equipment and hide equipment and use it. So,
and sometimes that equipment isn't even being used anyways. I mean, I've just seen so much equipment in the hospitals that are collecting dust. A lot of times working with these teams, we're not even really having to like invest in new equipment. It's just, how do you utilize equipment you need, or where can you find equipment that you're going to use that other people aren't?
Right. I agree with that.
Anything else you would leave with the IC community?
No, I'm super appreciative to be on this platform, and certainly am open to any PTs, OTs, or nurses that want to reach out and talk through whether that's the Ramsey protocol or mobilizing ECMO or, you know, any early mobility sort of topics. And I know you're a great resource for that as well. So I'm always open and happy to help in any way I can. And then I would say learn from my failures as much as the successes. So I've got plenty of those too.
Well, I'm just shooting from the hip here, but I think it'd be great if listeners submitted case studies, questions, and have you back on, and we could walk through, even if it's, you know, a patient that you've had that you wonder, could things have gone different? I would love to hear Stephen's thoughts on this. I think it's really powerful to do case studies of, here's what went right, but here's where it could have gone wrong, or here's what went wrong, here's where it could have gone right. So submit your ideas, and let's have Stephen back on the podcast.
Thank you so much for that. I'd love to be back.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye.
We'll be right back. schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.